Hey guys, welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. This is my podcast. Thanks for stopping by. This one is a big one for all John Green fans. You know who you are, your nerd fighters. Whether you're a nerd fighter or just a casual fan or just curious about who I'm talking to, or if you've heard a little bit about Fault in Our Stars and curious about that, this week's episode is a really special one. John Green is a force of nature in publishing right now, in vlogging and video blogging. Obviously, he is huge. His fans, I've kind of never seen anything like it, and it's no wonder why. I've gotten a chance to talk to John a bunch in the last few months and gotten to know him thanks to my covering of this film, The Fault in Our Stars, which opens this Friday, which is going to be huge. I know it. It really checks all the boxes for fans of the book, and I've seen it with audiences, and I've seen them respond. And it's, if you don't know it already, it's a love story. It stars Shailene Woodley and the next big thing, which is Mr. Ansel Elgort, and it all comes from the brain of John Green, and he is so entertaining in this podcast, so open, so funny. It was such a thrill to talk to him. He literally just left the office moments ago as I tape this, and tonight on Monday as I tape this is the big premiere here in New York, the world premiere for The Fault in Our Stars, and this Friday all of you guys can check it out, and I know you will. So I'm not going to say much more except to say, as always, hit me up on Twitter, Joshua Horowitz. Tell me who you want to hear on the next podcast, because I do want to hear from you guys and know what I'm doing right and what I can improve on and who you just want to hear. And as always, check out all my stuff on MTV.com and MTVNews.com and AfterHours.MTV.com and just all the .coms. And I think that's all the plugging for today. So without any further ado, here is John Green.
Is this where I'm sitting?
Yeah.
Make yourself at home. How's it going?
Good. Where'd you fit in on the approval matrix?
I made it to brilliant lowbrow. Which?
I was brilliant highbrow.
Were you really?
I was.
There's a rivalry.
I fucked up your mic.
Adjust as you see fit. Well, you're a pro.
I actually don't know how it
looks like you know what you're doing.
Yeah, but.
Oh, now I got it.
He got it. Would someone mind closing the. Actually, we'll wait on some soda, right? No, you got it.
I got the soda. Thank now we're man. Good.
Don't lock us in. Don't you dare. I can't survive in here with John Green all day. thanks for stopping by, man. It's good to see you. It's been a whole, 12, 15 hours?
I know, yeah. It's good to see you, too. Hold on. I'm looking at who you're podcasting with in the future. It's a very impressive list.
Don't reveal the secrets.
I won't. I'm not going to say it on the podcast, but I'm just going to say the listeners have a lot to look forward to.
Who knew that Charo was still out there doing press for the Love Boat?
I know. I'm just going to stay under your desk so that I can hang out with Charo.
Right. It's pretty exciting. I don't know why my first reference to the podcast was a 30-year-old Love Boat actress, but we're off and running, I guess.
Yeah, although I think it's hard to argue that Charo's 30.
Well, I was going to say 30, meaning in the 30 years ago she was relevant, but she's still relevant.
She's relevant. Yeah, if she's not relevant, how come we spent the first 2 minutes of our special talk talking about her?
It's so exciting to see you, especially this time. I mean, as we talk today, hours away from the New York premiere,
yeah.
The big premiere. Everything about all the events in this are, as you well know, you must be getting a headache in the best possible way from the screaming fans. It's been crazy.
It's been very difficult for me to get my head around, but I'm just trying to enjoy it, and I'm so grateful to everybody for coming out and supporting the movie.
Yeah. Does it feel like I'm in a privileged position when I cover films like this, and I get to – I feel in a small way I get to, like, ride along with you guys through this process, and I got to visit you guys on set. And it's honestly always exciting to then – to see, I mean, I was at that screening a month or two ago here in New York, and I literally never heard – like that kind of response in a crowd.
Yeah, me neither.
That doesn't happen in movies. Does it? I mean, I would think it doesn't get old. It's always bizarre and shocking, and that's not what the human brain is meant to deal with on a regular basis.
Yeah, yeah. Brains are not designed to deal well with crowds. They aren't designed to deal well with yelling. But the thing I keep telling myself is that I'm very, very lucky that they made such a good movie, yeah. Because that's no credit to me and all credit to the filmmakers. I got really lucky. You know, so many books that I love were turned into movies that I don't love. It's a very rare thing to be in this situation, and I'm just so proud of the movie and so excited about it.
You've talked a lot about how you in the past you've shied away from doing a ton of television press, and obviously the nature of a movie, trying to get the word out on this is like, you know, I saw you this morning on the Today Show. It doesn't get much bigger than that.
I have been on TV more times in the last 3 hours than in the previous 10 years. Because I hate being on, no offense to television people, but I kind of hate being on television. I find it very stressful and weird, and you can't control your image, and it's just a weird thing. And
so what are the devices for coping? Have you figured out like a...
There's a great Robert Frost quote, "The only way out is through." But I felt, I really like this movie, and I felt like I had to say thank you, and the only way that I can say thank you is by doing press. Yeah. You know, so this is fun. Like this is chill and cool, and it's good to hang out with you. And I know you, and I like you, and no one can see our faces right now.
you don't know about the cameras. Like,
oh God!
Secretly hidden.
Oh God! Is this a vodcast?
Only for you. Only for you. Does it feel like It's because it's an odd kind of conundrum about you. You're a very, in many ways, you're a very public person. Obviously, you put a lot of yourself out there, thanks to the vlogging and the obviously your writing. Yet you have to keep some things back. Have you had to wrestle with that over the last few years in terms of like what you keep to yourself?
You know, we've had to think about it a little more, my wife and I, than we used to, because even when there's long been a very supportive community of Nerdfighters who made our work possible and did great projects with us, and that's still a huge part of our lives, and it will be hopefully as long as I'm working. But you know, in the last couple of years, with so much more attention and the book reading reaching a much, much broader audience than Sarah or I ever imagined possible. I mean, this never crossed our minds. We've had to be a lot more cautious just in the way we deal with our kids, because I want our kids, you know, we live in Indiana, and I want our kids to have normal Midwestern lives, and to not have to think about this stuff too much. I don't want my kids to think about their parents too much. Like, I never really understood what my dad did for a living, and I think that was a great blessing to me.
Right. I mean, I know you spent time here in New York years ago. Will Indiana remain home? Is that important for you guys to?
I really love it there. I'm really happy there, and we have great friends. I miss New York sometimes. I miss being able to order sushi at 3:30 in the morning. I miss the energy of the city. This is such a special place. There really is no place I've ever been that's remotely like it. But a lot of the things that I dislike about being a person, like standing in line and getting a driver's license and the sort of like general oppression of crowds and bureaucracy, these are not things that New York is great at dealing with.
So you're saying you're really happy to be right here in Times Square right now?
it's a delight.
I always say, yeah, it might be the one demerit of this job is the last 5 blocks of my commute of just through the lovely tourists. But
it's a lot of very stressful weaving. You have to weave and weave, and everyone is nice. And I have to say, I mean, one of the nice things about New York is that the people who are well-known are treated with a great deal of respect in New York. That isn't the case really anywhere else.
Exactly.
I think Daniel Radcliffe once called it his only heads-up city, like the only city where he doesn't have to look at his shoes when he's walking.
It's an important factor when you're Harry Potter.
Yeah.
It's also got to be kind of like a screw the brain a little bit, knowing that, you know, you're the same guy you were basically, I would think, you know, 5-10 years ago. And 5-10 years ago, as you've been open about, like, you know, you would have like a book reading or something, and there would be what, 5 people in the audience? And
if I was lucky, I would be delighted with 5.
So how do you reconcile that you're the same guy up there, yeah, and that was most of your life, and now you're in this weird period that hopefully will continue where You're Mick Jagger up there. it's crazy.
A young Mick Jagger,
right.
To be clear. Not current Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger is still young. He will live past beyond all of us, let's be honest.
He's sort of pickled. I mean that in a loving way, Mick Jagger. I know he's a huge fan of the podcast.
He does love it. Hey, Mick, see you next week.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. I'll still be here cowering under Horowitz's desk waiting for you. Yeah, it is at times difficult to reconcile. But, you know, the main thing is that my professional life is not my life, and what I do for a living is not me. Right. As long as I can hold on to that, as long as I can hold on to the sense that my life, my identity, my sense of self is not wrapped up in my work, then when 5 people come to my readings, it won't be devastating. And when 10,000 people come to my readings, it won't make me think that I am a different person or a better person or whatever. I mean, the great privilege and opportunity of consciousness is being able to relate to other people, but it has to be on a real personal level. So the most important, I mean, the relationships that I have with the Nerdfighter community is tremendously important to me, but the most important relationships in my life are with my family, my closest friends, and, you know, that stuff hasn't really changed. They don't care. I mean, my 1-year-old baby definitely doesn't care, but even, you know, no, they don't care. They're proud of me in the same way that I'm proud of them when good stuff happens at their work.
Going back a little bit, when did you realize that you could make a living at this? What was the turning point?
I mean, my first novel came out. It sold a couple thousand copies in the first year. And but somehow I could make a living because I'd had some foreign deals. And also, I had no needs back then. I was living very inexpensively. And there's lots of different ways to sort of piece together a living writing, and lots of freelance jobs and stuff. And it occurred to me that I could just do it. But then I didn't actually want to. I like having a day job. I like having steady income. It's weird to me not to have a day job. It feels very scary. So I like not having to mentally rely upon the idea of writing a certain book by a certain deadline that has to sell a certain number of copies. That limits my creative expression and creative experience. So I still work. I mean, I still do Crash Course, online education series on YouTube, and you know, we're lucky to work with lots of nonprofit organizations on that stuff. And you know, I go into the office every day. And
so you consider that's the day job.
That's the day job. I go in the office every day. I do it, but then in the morning I try to write.
Gotcha. I mean, I was curious because, like, when looking at the output of your material, I mean, there's such a, in addition to the books, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much out there that you've produced already. I mean, and most of our brains have a finite amount of creative juice and energy. I mean, do you worry that, like, does the well run dry at a certain point, or does it run dry for a period of time? And does the online videos take away anything from the writing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the hope I find in that is that I wrote Fault in Our Stars while I was making videos, and it was by far my best received book. So I take some hope away from that. I do worry about it sometimes. On the other hand, at times I feel like the well doesn't run dry as long as you're pumping, you know? The well doesn't run dry as long as you're working, and it's when I stop working that the well runs dry. Also, I mean, I've had some mental health problems in my life and periods where, you know, when you're in a state of really profound obsessiveness or depression or whatever, you don't get much done, and that becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Right. Then you get mad at yourself for not getting anything done. So I feel very lucky to be in a place in my life where I can work, where I have the energy, where I have the excitement, where I have an audience that gets me excited to work every day. So I try to focus on that. I do work a little bit too much sometimes, but I like it. I really like it. I like all the stuff that I do.
Does the writing come in spurts? I mean, is it more routinized? You say you try and write in the morning. I mean, do you find, like, you'll wake up at 3 in the morning and write 10 pages?
Cause no, I wish. I love those people who can do that. I think that's so awesome. Like, they just wake up inspired. They had a dream, and the dream was perfect. I wake up, and I had a dream, and I'm like, that dream would make an amazing novel. And then I write it down, and I'm like, this is insane. I have to burn this so that no one ever finds it. No, I do write in spurts. I mean, it takes me a long time to get sort of started. So I'll write 100,000 words that I can say very little of, and then I'll find my way into a narrative voice that I can follow through. And then suddenly, you know, the novel comes out, the draft of it anyway, relatively quickly.
Right.
But I just have to trust that process. And for me, that means being disciplined and trying to, you know, write on a schedule as much as I can, as many days as I can.
Are you critical of your own work? I mean, did Fault come more naturally in a more, did it feel like once you had that first draft of it, did you have to go back and edit it a lot? Or did it feel like this beyond the other works feels more complete? It feels like I nailed it the first time.
Oh no, I always delete more than half of my first drafts. And that was very much the same case for Fault in Our Stars. I mean, they were some wretched wretched parts of it. But I'm glad I knew that, you know, this at this point in my career, like I've done it a few times, so it's not devastating to me to have to delete 70% of a first draft. I understand that that's just part of my process, and unless I magically find some more efficient way of doing it, like that's going to be the way that I write probably for the rest of my career.
Right. I'm curious also, like, in an experience like this, which is so unique and just it happens once in a lifetime if you're lucky for a creative type, where audiences graft onto material and make it their own, and then a film is made and you're happy with the film, and that's its own thing. It's obviously not a literal adaptation, but it is a very faithful one. Do you feel like more connected with the book? Is your relationship with your own book different now, thanks to both the fans and that the fact that by the nature of the medium, there's a different interpretation of it out there?
That's a good question, man. That's a really interesting question. In some ways, I feel closer to it, but in the most important ways, I feel more able to let it go. I feel more able to let it belong to other people and to let it, hopefully have a place in their lives. It's a very personal story for me. It's hard to write. It was painful to write. I should add, whenever I complain about writing, there's a little voice inside of my head. It's my dad. And it's my dad saying to me, as he has said to me many, many times when I complain about my job, "Well, kid, it ain't coal mining," and it ain't. And I don't want to. I don't want to sound like it's so wretched to have to sit at a typewriter or computer every day and move my fingers over a keyboard. But it was a difficult book for me to write, and it was, I hope I came to a hopeful place with it, but it was a long road getting there. It's been a great gift to me that so many people have responded so generously to the book, that these people made the movie so well, because it has been a way of sort of letting me let go of some of those fears, some of those things that terrify me about being a human. And I do feel a lot better. I do feel a lot better in my relationship to human life and to the universe than I did before all of this. And I don't think it's because the book has been successful. I think it's because the readers of the book and the people who made the movie have given me this great gift of kind of believing with me in the idea that short lives can also be meaningful lives, and in the idea that there is meaning to life. It doesn't matter if it's constructed or if we derive it from somewhere, it can still be real.
I'm curious, one thing I appreciate about your work, and I think a lot of your fans do as well, is that for some YA, whatever you want to call it, is stigma, maybe is too harsh a word, but some people almost view it as a lesser thing.
Yeah.
And you embrace it. This is what you do best, and there's nothing to apologize for in connecting with teenagers in the way that you do.
Yeah.
Was that something you had to reconcile a little bit, or that you had to feel like you were apologizing in the beginning, or did you always feel like, yeah, this is what I do best, and this is awesome that I can connect with such an important part of the development of a human being?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, very early on, I wanted to write a YA novel because I admired so many YA novels. I'd started reading them as an adult when I started working at this magazine Booklist, and I was blown away by how good they were. But there was still a little part of me that was like, I want to be a proper fancy writer. I want to be a writer who gets proper fancy reviews and all of that stuff. It turns out that I have gotten a lot of proper fancy reviews, and I'm very grateful for that. But there is still a stigma associated with it. I think that I kind of get a pass on that stigma, partly because of a lot of privileges associated with, my sex and my race, but also because I write so-called realistic fiction. And one of the things I actually love most about YA is that I share a shelf with science fiction and fantasy and mysteries and all kinds of romances. I mean, I write romance, but a wide variety of romance, and I share a shelf with dystopian novels. And I love that. I love that those books can be in conversation with each other, and that we aren't drawing these bright lines between, genre fiction and proper fiction, because I think of myself as a genre fiction writer, and I wish I could write fantasy. I have tried to write fantasy, and my friends have kindly told me that I should probably stick with what I'm good at. But we're so lucky in YA to live in a relatively diverse publishing climate where teenagers, move back and forth in their readings, and they're comfortable reading both, you know, they're comfortable reading dystopias, they're comfortable reading urban fantasy and realistic fiction, and that's really important to me.
I think it's also been cool from my perspective, like, I've been able to interview, you know, a bunch of folks in that space, including, like, Veronica Roth and Cassandra, and there really seems to be camaraderie among you guys. I mean,
there
Veronica
is.
Just tweeted something at you the other day I saw. It seems like it's a very, like, collegial atmosphere, to say the least.
It's a tremendously supportive community. I have to say that I don't know about much about the world of adult fiction, but I don't think maybe it's quite so supportive. You know, we are all fans of each other's books. I'm a fan of Cassandra Clare. I am a huge fan of Veronica Roth. I am a fan of these writers. I buy their books the day they come out. You know, I love Holly Black and I love Walter Dean Myers and I love Jackie Woodson and I love their books. Like beg Jackie Woodson for a pre-publication galley of her most recent book and got it yesterday and have been like reading it while I'm having to do all of this interview stuff. Like as soon as I'm done talking to you, I'm going to go back to reading Brown Girl Dreaming. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. We're very lucky to have it.
How much did you think J.K. Rowling change publishing, change your space?
I mean, I think J.K. Rowling made it possible. I think that children's books, YA books, first off, they were seen as only for children and teenagers, not for adult readers. But more importantly, they were seen as sort of an afterthought in the world of publishing. And now, you know, we live in a world in which probably 20 of the 50 best-selling books in the United States are published for teenagers or children. That's a very different world from the one that we lived in even 10 years ago when I started publishing. And I think that a lot of credit goes to J.K. Rowling. I think not enough credit goes to Stephanie Meyer. I think Stephanie Meyer also opened up a lot of doors for YA novels in terms of adult readership, broad adult readership, and that's made a huge difference as well.
Have you spent time with J.K.? Have you ever?
No, I have never met J.K. Rowling. I couldn't. I would never. I wouldn't know what to say. I would freak out. I don't want to meet her.
Sweat starts pouring down.
Seriously, you're making me anxious just imagining it. I never meet
J.K. Come out.
Never meet your idols. Is she going to be on the pod? No, I am. I'm so grateful to her as a writer, but also because the world that she created has been such a hugely important part of the video blog community that Hank and I have been lucky to be at the front of for the last 7.5 years. I mean, Hank sings songs about Harry Potter. We go to Harry Potter conferences. Right. Like I was going to Harry Potter cons a long, long time ago, and the thought of actually meeting her, I don't know. No, thank you.
Can you deal with Radcliffe at least? He's the nicest.
I could deal with Radcliffe. I could totally deal with Radcliffe. He seems like a really cool guy.
He is literally the nicest dude on the planet.
Is he? Yeah, he seems like he is.
You guys would get along, I think.
Oh, that's cool.
So talk to me a little bit about, I mean, the fact that this was not your first, this is your first, obviously, book that's been adapted for Hollywood, but it wasn't your first, the process wasn't the first for you.
Yeah.
What was the first one? Was it for Paper Towns or what was?
No, it was for Looking for Alaska, and it was shortly after the book came out, and it was amazing. It was life changing. It allowed us to move to New York. I was very, very. I'm still very, very grateful that that happened.
And that was selling the rights to Paramount, basically. Right?
Yeah, we sold the rights to Paramount, and then you know Paramount's still has the rights and will have them forever. And they will choose when to make a movie and what movie to make and whether to make a movie. And if I can be of use to them in that process, I'm happy to do it. There was a couple great scripts along the line written by Josh Schwartz, who created the OC, and he just did a great job. And they just didn't see a way to make it. And Hollywood is a very complicated business that I don't have a great understanding of, but. That one's out of my control. The other ones are in my control, which is awesome, and I'm very lucky about that and very grateful for it. Some of them were optioned, but they've all returned to me now.
One would think, I don't want to jinx anything, but after opening weekend of this one, that suddenly there will be a lot more movement. I mean, Paper Towns is already obviously moving.
Yeah.
But suddenly a lot of people, maybe Paramount might be giving you a call. Have they already talked about potentially?
Yeah, we've had some conversations. Look, the main thing to me is not, there is something magical about reading a book where you haven't seen the movie, right, or where you don't know the movie adaptation, because the characters belong to you. They are wholly inside of your minds. If you're the kind of person who pictures characters when you read, you can picture them. If you're not, like, I don't really picture faces when I read or anything, but the thing that's happening inside of your consciousness is so special and weird and powerful. And the visual image, I think, is, you know, it's so ingrained in us as central. We live in such a culture of hyper-saturated images that, or hyper-saturated with images, that, like, I think it's very difficult then to read a book and not see those people, right, you know? So I think I'm okay if they don't make a movie. To me, the question is not, like, should we make a movie? The question is, can we make a good movie?
Right.
And if the answer to that question is yes, then let's do it. Like, if it's going to be as good as The Fault in Our Stars, and it's going to be as wonderful an experience, and I'm going to have amazing friends out of it, like Shailene and Ansel and Nat and Laura Dern and Sam Trammell, like, yeah, absolutely, let's do it. But if it's not going to be a great movie, let's not.
So it occurs to me, as you were talking, like, have they put out a version of Fault in Our Stars with the actors on the cover?
Yeah.
And is that's okay with you?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was not psyched about it, to be honest with you. I've never been a big fan of the movie tie-in edition, as it's called. But, you know, a couple months spending time with Shailene and Ansel in Pittsburgh and Amsterdam, I started to think, you know, these young people have given so much to this book, and they have been given such extraordinary life to Hazel and Augustus, that I'm honored that they're on the cover. I'm honored that they get to share that book with me, and I will always treasure that my copy of that book.
Yeah, it's exciting to also see, and I've gone through this a couple times, like watching films in development come to fruition, and to see kind of a star born. Shailene was already a star, but see the fever around Ansel. And the excitement, and I mean, obviously he's a great-looking guy, but he's got just charisma to spare, and this is by far his first leading role, like,
yeah,
role. It's just, it must be fun just as, like, a fan and friend to kind of see him emerge through this, too.
I am excited for him. I also think that he probably doesn't know what's about to happen,
I know.
So I'm excited for him, but I also want to, like, hold on to him real tight. He's just a wonderfully talented guy, and he just did such a great job in this movie. I mean, I don't think I was a big fan of his and a huge advocate for him being cast as Augustus, but I had no idea he was going to be that good.
Yeah.
And I think he understood Gus in profound ways, and yeah, he's going to be his life is about to change for sure. But I'm so excited for him, and he. He's going to have a great career, I think, as an actor, because he is wildly talented.
This Friday, I know there are a bunch of events. Obviously, there's the premiere tonight here in New York. I think you guys are doing an event the night before, like the night.
Thursday night,
right?
Yeah.
Are you also, like, are you just going to be kind of going from theater to theater trying to, I mean, if I were you, I would want to just, like, soak in that reaction, because it's going to be so cathartic,
yeah,
for people, and it's going to be just a buzz to feel it. Are you going to be out in the theaters this next weekend?
Yeah, yeah. I can't, I mean...
And
I can't,
tell us where exactly. And
what showings and what theaters? I am going to go to the theater with my wife and some of our friends, and, you know, sit in the back and just enjoy that magic moment of that you know we've been building toward for the last almost 3 years since this book came out, and then I'm going to go on vacation with my kids to a place with no cell phone service and no Wi-Fi.
Undisclosed cave.
Yeah, exactly.
What's your disguise going to be in the theater? Because everyone in that theater is going to...
I'm not
going to
have a disguise. I figure if you walk in like a minute after the movie starts and you sit in the back row, no one's going to notice.
You're a tall drink of water.
Maybe. My wife is always telling me to wear a hat. Like, whenever we leave the house now, she's like, why don't you put on your hat? And I'm like, because it's not like the hat is magical. Like, I still look like myself. People would just be like, oh, hey, that's John Green in a hat.
And thus a new meme is born.
Right, yeah, yeah, like hat me or whatever. I don't want, yeah. I don't really like the way I look in a hat. I'm too old to, like, regularly wear a baseball cap.
Are you the kind of guy that thinks about career in terms of, like, where you're going to be in 5 years? Because, I mean, is it – do you see yourself primarily now, like, if, you know, on a immigration form or something, do you write writer? I mean, what do you – you know what I mean?
I always write novelist and video blogger, which I'm sure is the most pretentious answer on your immigration form when you're visiting Canada. And they're like, oh, thank you for way too much information about your life, man. Yeah. But I think of I like both. I love making video. The educational work that we do with the Art Assignment and with Crash Course is so important to me, and I think and it's important to, you know, millions of young people around the world, and that's not something that I could ever give up. And I love writing books, and I'm going to keep writing books, partly because I don't have another good source of income, but also because I do genuinely love that. I love it. I love the process of writing. I love being inside the world of a book. I miss it. I'm really looking forward to getting back to that. Like, all of this stuff is fun, but like at my core, I'm a person who wants to sit in a basement and write all day.
That being said, and maybe you can deny this all you want, you're really good with a crowd, with people. You're actually, I mean,
thanks, man.
As nervous as you may be inside,
yeah.
You command an audience. I mean, were you ever like an aspiring performer growing up? Did you want to act?
I was in a sketch comedy group in college, and I quite enjoyed it. I was terrible. Unfortunately, I am not a good actor. But
we'll
all
discuss the cut cameo. That's already it's been done to death.
Yeah, my cameo is cut. It wasn't cut because I was bad. It was cut because the scene didn't work in the movie.
I thought you were about to blame the kid in the scene.
No, the kid was amazing. The kid was so good. That's the only sad thing about it is that I played Girl's father, and Girl was amazing. She was adorable.
She held up her end.
Ugh. No, she did a great job. I apologize to Sophie. But
you were in sketch comedy, it just didn't take?
I loved writing sketches, and I loved like hanging out with my friends. But the actual acting part, I wasn't very good at all.
Gotcha. What about, would you want to try your hand again at screenwriting? I know you tried to adapt.
No, I'm so bad. I'm epically bad. Screenwriting requires a lot of understanding of structure.
Right.
I realized when I was writing the screenplay for Paper Towns that I don't actually know anything about plot. And none of my books really have plots as such. It's just that they have a series of things that happen and then they end. But they're not like structurally sound as stories.
Uh-huh.
And I thought maybe that was just because I wasn't that interested in it. But it turns out that even when I try to devote myself to it, I still suck at it. So that's a good thing to know about yourself.
It's important.
Yeah.
Do you outline the books before you?
I don't. Sometimes I outline a little, but I first drafts for me are sort of an outline, which is why I delete almost all of them at the end.
Again, not to like put a dark cloud over your amazing career, but have you also thought about the fact that, like, what if The Fault in Our Stars is the one?
Let's not kid ourselves.
Well, I mean,
it's the one.
It's
the one.
And however you want to define that.
Yeah, it's the one.
Is it the one?
Yeah, of course. This doesn't happen twice. You know, I'm not like Terry McMillan or John Grisham or something. Like, I'm not gonna be someone who goes on and has this kind of success over and over again. Nor, to be fair, is that really my ambition? Like, it seems hard, frankly.
One could argue the people that repeat are the ones that don't court it anyway. So you're sounding like the person that will repeat.
Oh, great.
Because if you said that you were, then you would not, if that makes
sense. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, but like, to me, I can't worry about it that much. I've got to write. You know, the next book and let it be its own thing, you know, not let it be a follow-up to The Fault in Our Stars, because that's not going to happen. I feel very, very lucky that this is happening, but I also feel like, to be honest with you, that I'm proud of the book. I like the book. I still like it. I think it has some weaknesses for sure, and like there's a lot of insufficiencies that I spend a lot of time thinking about, but like, I also understand that the real story of this book is not about me, or even about the book. It's about the generosity that many readers have shown it, and then the amazing good luck to have a good movie made.
We know you're a voracious reader. Also consume a lot of TV, movies.
I watch more TV than I used to, but still very little. I'm a binge watcher of certain programs. I love Orange is the New Black. I enjoy Homeland. That might be it. Yeah. Deadliest Catch.
Really?
Sometimes.
That's a wild card.
Well, my dad was a fisherman in Alaska.
Oh, wow.
And I have always admired him. He is like tough in all the ways that my brother and I aren't. He's hiked the Appalachian Trail. He's, you know, almost lost an eye. And, you know, he's got stories about bears. And I'm like, you know, I mowed the lawn once.
And it got hot.
Yeah, it was so hot. And then halfway through, I just called someone to finish it. But yeah, I like that show a little bit. But I love Orange is the New Black. I'm very excited for the new season. Yeah, June 6th. But first, go see The Fault in Our Stars. Then go binge watch Orange is the New Black. That's my plan.
Right. No, that makes sense. That's a perfect day.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe start with Fault. Go watch, what is it, probably 10 new episodes or something.
Yeah.
And then bridge it with a little more Fault.
Yeah, maybe then go to the 10 o'clock showing of Fault.
And find some food somewhere in there.
Oh, you can eat at the movie theater. Twice. I've just gotten you two great meals of popcorn.
You're welcome, America, nay the world. In our remaining minutes, I've got this bizarre, weird Indiana Jones fedora.
I love it.
Obviously has random questions in there, because what else would you fill it with?
Yeah.
Would you care to take a few and take a stab at
it? I'm very excited.
I know, I can tell.
All right, so I'm going to grab one here.
Here we go, read it.
Let's you write these?
If they're good, yes.
Favorite cartoon character, Ferb. On Phineas and Ferb, a wonderful program.
Yeah.
I have a child, so that's why I know that show. But also, even if I didn't have kids, I would still watch it. Have you ever seen it?
I'm aware, but I have not.
It's a game changer.
Really?
Your life is about to get so
I'm
much
so
better.
Excited. Thank you, John, in advance.
First concert. I don't want to brag.
I don't think you are in a second.
Oh, I am going to brag, because my first concert was an amazingly cool concert.
Go for it. I'm excited now.
They Might Be Giants.
Winner.
Still love them. Still go to their shows all the time.
Is that true?
I do. I am a huge They Might Be Giants fan, and I saw them when I was 13. My brother was 10. Even more impressive. And the most interesting person in the world is... That's a difficult call, because my heart says Beyonce.
is that true? Is your heart saying that, or is your mind saying that?
I don't know. Everything inside of me is saying Beyonce, so maybe I should just give up and say it's Beyonce.
Listeners should know he's now doing the single ladies dance.
I am. It's a wireless mic, so I can do it while I talk to you guys, and I don't lose my breath because I'm so fit. All right. When was the last time I cried?
Oh, God. That's like made for you. That's...
Yeah. I mean, when was the last time I went through a day without crying? I am a crier. I am a notorious crier. I cried every day on the set of the Fault in Our Stars movie, even in very funny scenes. Nat or Ansel or Shay would come back and they would be like, "Why are you crying? That was all jokes." And I was like, "I'm crying because you guys have been so kind to my story and it just means so much to me." I cried yesterday. Thinking about as my parents came in for the movie and they said nice things to me and they said they were proud of me and I cried. My dad can't say he's proud of me without him and I both crying before he gets to the puh in proud.
Is it ugly cry? I mean, is it kind of like...
No, I am a beautiful crier. I am.
Dignity. Grace.
Full
a
dignity.
Manly cry.
I never sob. Right. It's just like the Last of the Mohican style, single tear dripping down the cheek. I never let it get to sobbing. Occasionally, I let it get to sobbing.
Right. Well, that makes it special.
Yeah, but that's very rare. The last day of shooting, I wept into Shailene's shoulder and like heaved sobs, but she was also heaving sobs.
And that feeds on each other. Once, like, you know.
Oh yeah. Once one person gets going, it's over.
One or two more, maybe.
When was the last time you threw up? Also recently.
Is that connected to crying?
Well, I mean, insofar as it's connected to anxiety. But yeah, it was a couple days ago. Just feeling a little anxious going into this stuff. And blah!
And for the record, he just actually vomited in my office.
I did. Sorry, Josh. It was just now. It was just now. I assume. Yeah, but you know, this carpet isn't that nice. It's no big deal.
No, we were going to reupholster anyway. It's fine.
I would hope so. You know, and I always associated MTV with being so hip and cool and young.
Oh, please. There's so much throwing up on the floor at MTV News. This
good.
Is like
good.
Sway vomits here every week. That's crazy.
That's wonderful. In 20 years, I will be, oh, God, 56 years old. What will I be doing?
Literally. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. I've answered the question. Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, my kids will be in college. Oh, I mean, I hope that Sarah and I are traveling a lot and seeing the world and that I'm still writing and Sarah's still curating and we get to do stuff that we love. That would be awesome. That would be awesome.
And then there'll be the Fault in Our Stars reboot, too.
Well, yeah, I'll be also writing. I'll be, like, really hard up for money and I'll be trying to figure out a way to write a sequel to The Fault in Our Stars, you know, the way that you do when things go sour. gave all your money to Bernie Madoff and... Here you are.
If you still give your money to Bernie Madoff, you are a very unwise man.
He's just writing me from prison. It's so compelling.
What is a pyramid scheme, by the way?
Yeah. Anyway, it's going to be called Fault in Our Stars 2, Electric Boogaloo. I've already decided on the title. I just don't know the plot yet. I think most of it's going to take place in heaven, but then there might be some earth stuff, too.
And there'll be dancing, which always helps. Well,
it's a musical.
Yeah.
It has to be.
Duh.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's the place to end it, unless you like this next question. What do you think, John? I want you dictate the ending.
This is a good last question.
Okay, let's do it.
Zombies or vampires, which is one of the central questions of our time.
It is.
I am a longtime supporter of zombies. I also enjoy a good vampire. I love a good vampire book. I love vampires in books, but in actual real life, I like zombies. And I want to ask you a question, is what is your zombie apocalypse survival plan? And then I will tell you mine.
Honestly, there is no survival plan. Whether it's zombies or a hurricane or the floods coming, I'm just going to cower in a corner and just like eat a Cinnabon and check out of society.
Is very similar to my plan. We are such
kindred spirits.
Are such kindred spirits.
What's
my
yours?
Plan is if there's an actual zombie apocalypse, as soon as possible, run headfirst into the zombies. I don't want to go through. I don't want to see people I love be destroyed by zombieism. I want them to watch me be destroyed by zombieism. I want out as quickly as possible.
Most disturbing aspect is you've really put a lot of time and effort into
it. Oh, yeah. No, I am ready. I am ready. If there are even three zombies out there, I shall be the fourth.
Zombies, he's your first victim. John Green, master of the zombie apocalypse, amazing author of The Fault in Our Stars. Congratulations on the book. We're so excited for the film. And enjoy this crazy week. Enjoy this moment, man. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Josh. So good to see you.
Always a pleasure.
That was so fun.
So good.
God, that was
genuinely enjoyable. Well, wait, that's not supposed to happen on a press tour?
No, I know. It was a huge relief because nothing else has been enjoyable today.
Say that.
Thank you. That was so fun.